All right, welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're going to be tackling a Supreme Court case that is pretty crucial if you're at all interested in appellate law, particularly for indigent defendants. That case is Smith v. Robbins, decided back in 2000.
Oh, a fascinating case. Absolutely.
Yeah, and you know, at its heart, Smith v. Robbins really grapples with this fundamental question of when someone can't afford a lawyer for their appeal, does the Constitution actually mandate a very specific way of doing things when their appointed counsel thinks that appeal is a lost cause? Or can states kind of come up with their own ways of handling this whole situation?
It's a great question, and it's one that I think really highlights some of the tensions that we see in the law all the time, right? Between trying to have a consistent approach at the federal level and then recognizing that states often have different needs, different resources, different ways that they've traditionally done things, and how do you reconcile those two things? That's what this case is about.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, for our listeners who are mostly law students, you know, they're going to be encountering this you know, whether they're going into criminal law or even if they're not. I mean, appellate procedure is something that you're going to encounter probably at some point in your career. So it's a good one to know.
Oh, absolutely.
So to even like understand what's really at stake in Smith v. Robbins, we have to go back a bit, right? We need to talk about the gold standard, the procedure that was already in place, and that's the Anders procedure.
Right, right. From Anders v. California, 1967 case.
Yeah. So what are the key elements of this Anders framework?
So Anders is all about what happens when you have a court-appointed attorney who believes that their client's appeal is, for lack of a better term, frivolous. That means there's no real legitimate legal arguments that can be made. And so the Supreme Court in Anders said, okay, well, here's what you have to do. And they laid out this very specific step-by-step procedure. The first thing is that the lawyer has to file what's called an Anders brief. And it's important to know that this isn't just a brief saying like, oh, this appeal is weak. They have to go through and actually find anything in the case record that could even arguably support the appeal, even if they, as the lawyer, think that argument is ultimately going to fail.
So even if the lawyer thinks it's a losing case, they have to lay out the potential argument.
Exactly. Exactly. So the court can see it. The client can see it. Everyone's on the same page.
Transparency.
Exactly. And then the next step is the attorney has to ask the court to withdraw from the case. And by asking to withdraw, that's kind of their signal that they're saying, look, I think this is frivolous. I don't think there's anything here. And then what happens is both the court and the defendant themselves are given a chance to look at the entire case record, look at the Anders brief, and decide, is there actually something here? So you have multiple checks built into the system.
Okay, so it's a process designed to really ensure that no stone is left unturned.
That's the idea. That's the idea.
Even if, you know, the lawyer initially thinks, I don't think there's anything here.
Right.
Now, that's the Anders procedure. But Smith v. Robbins really revolves around California doing things a little differently. They have something called the Wendy procedure. So how does Wendy actually differ?
So California, with their Wendy procedure, decided to go a different direction. So let's say you have appointed counsel. They look at the case and they say, you know, I think this appeal is frivolous. What they do is they file a brief and it summarizes the procedural history, the facts of the case. But here's the big difference. They don't have to identify any arguable issues. And they don't actually ask to withdraw from the case.
So no listing out the potential arguments and no formally stepping aside.
That's right. The thinking behind Wendy is that by the lawyer filing this brief, this is their way of certifying to the California Court of Appeal, look, I've looked at everything. I've done my due diligence. And then the court independently is supposed to review the entire record and see, are there any issues here? Now, the defendant still has the right to file their own brief and raise whatever points they want. But the question that comes up in Smith v. Robbins is this good enough? Is this Wendy procedure, this different way of doing things, constitutionally sound?
All right. That's a great kind of overview of the two different approaches. Now, let's get into the specifics of the case itself. What happened in Mr. Robbins's case that brought this issue all the way up to the Supreme Court?
So, Mr. Robbins, he was convicted in a California state court second-degree murder, grand theft auto.
Well, wow.
Pretty serious charges. And during the trial, he actually represented himself.
Interesting.
Yeah, he went pro se for the trial. But then for the appeal, he was appointed an attorney. And his appointed lawyer looked at everything and said, you know, I don't think there are any grounds for an appeal that are going to succeed. So instead of filing an Anders brief, the lawyer filed a brief under the California Wendy procedure, just laid out the facts, the history, didn't really raise any legal arguments.
And how did Mr. Robbins, you know, respond to this Wendy Breeze? Did he just kind of let it go, or did he try to do something about it?
So he actually did something. So Mr. Robbins, acting pro se again, filed his own brief with the California Court of Appeal. And in his brief, he said, look, I think there wasn't enough evidence for my conviction. And I also think the prosecution didn't turn over evidence that would have helped me.
Which is a Brady violation, right?
Yeah.
So even though his lawyer didn't raise these issues, he's trying to bring them to the court's attention.
So they have the Wenda brief. They have Mr. Robbins' own arguments. What did the California court do?
Well, they follow the Wenda procedure, right? So they did their own independent review of the record and ultimately decided, nope, we don't see any legal issues here. And they upheld his conviction.
But it didn't end there, right? He appealed again.
That's right. He didn't give up. Mr. Robbins was persistent. He filed a petition for a writ of habeas corpus in federal district court. And in that petition, he argued that basically he was denied effective assistance of counsel. He said, look, my lawyer didn't do what Andrews required. This Wenda procedure, it's not good enough.
And the federal district court agreed with him. They did.
Mm-hmm.
Surprisingly, they sided with Robbins, granted his petition, mm-hmm. and basically said, yeah, we think Wenda is not adequate. It doesn't meet the constitutional standard that we think Anders sets out.
So now it's California versus the federal courts.
Exactly. And of course, the state appealed.
Of course.
So up it goes to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals.
All right. And what happened to the Ninth Circuit?
Well, the Ninth Circuit also agreed with Mr. Robbins. So they're doubling down on this idea that Anders is not just a suggestion. It's the only way to do this constitutionally. And so now you have the situation where you have the state procedure and the federal court saying they're incompatible. And that's what leads it to the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
The Supreme Court sees this and says, okay, we've got to resolve this.
Yeah, a classic circuit split situation.
Yeah.
Right. So up to the Supreme Court it goes. What was the core legal issue that they were trying to sort out in Smith v. Robbins?
It boils down to this. Does the 14th Amendment, with its due process and equal protection clauses, require every state to follow the Anders procedure to the letter when appointed counsel thinks an appeal has no merit? Or can states, you know, can they experiment? Can they come up with different ways of doing things, like California with its Wendy procedure, as long as those other ways still protect the defendant's right to a lawyer?
Right. It's that balance again, right?
Yeah.
State flexibility versus individual rights.
Yeah.
So what did the Supreme Court actually decide?
In a decision that I think surprised some people, the Supreme Court actually reversed the Ninth Circuit.
Oh, wow. Okay.
They said, look, Anders, it's a good idea. It's a good framework. But it's not the only constitutionally acceptable way to do this. States can come up with their own procedures, like Wenda, as long as they still protect the right to counsel.
So Anders is more like a guideline, not the be-all, end-all.
Exactly. Guideline, not a mandate.
So why did the majority come to this conclusion? Let's dig into their reasoning a bit.
Okay, so Justice Thomas wrote the majority opinion, and he made a few really important points. The first is that he said Anders, you know, it created what he called a prophylactic framework. Now, think of prophylactic like a preventative measure, right? So Anders is trying to prevent the violation of the right to counsel on appeal.
So it's a way to head off problems before they happen.
Exactly. But Justice Thomas says this framework, it's not a constitutional command. The Constitution doesn't say you have to do it this way.
Okay. So some wiggle room there.
Right, right. And the court said, well, requiring every state to use the exact same procedure, that would go against this idea of letting states experiment with different ways to handle these tough policy issues.
You know, the whole laboratories of democracy concept.
Exactly. So states should have some freedom to find what works best for them as long as they're still protecting constitutional rights.
Makes sense. And the majority, they also specifically looked at the Wenda procedure itself. What did they have to say about that?
Yeah. So they looked at Wendy and said, well, we think this does enough to protect the defendant's rights. They pointed out a few things. One, even though the lawyer doesn't have to list specific issues, they still have to thoroughly review everything. And by filing the Wenda brief, that's like their way of saying, hey, court, I did my homework. I looked at everything carefully.
It's like their stamp of approval.
Right, exactly.
Right.
And then the court also said, look, the defendant, they can still file their own brief just like Mr. Robbins did. And most importantly, the California Court of Appeal, they have to do their own independent review. They can't just rely on what the lawyer said. They have to look for any possible legal issues. So the majority was basically saying, we think this combination of things, it's good enough.
It's a multi-layered safeguard. In their view.
Exactly.
Now, of course, not everyone on the court agreed. We had some dissenting opinions in this case,
no.
Right? Justices Stevens and Souter, they had some pretty strong words about the window procedure. What were their main concerns?
Yeah, they were not happy. Justice Stevens, in his dissent, said, "Look, Wendy, it totally undercuts what Anders was trying to do. He was really worried that by not making the lawyer point out the possible arguments, you're basically shifting that whole burden onto the judges. And judges, you know, they might not be as familiar with the details of the case as the lawyer who actually represented the client."
So they're worried that potentially important issues could slip through the cracks.
Exactly, exactly. Justice Stevens really felt strongly that Wendy was basically letting lawyers off the hook. Like, they could just file this brief summary and then step back and just let the court try to figure everything out. And he said, that's not what effective assistance of counsel is supposed to look like. Justice Souter agreed with him. He said, sure, independent judicial review is important, but it can't replace having a good lawyer who's really fighting for you and knows all the ins and outs of your case.
So the dissenters are really emphasizing the importance of that active advocacy role of the lawyer, especially for someone who can't afford to hire their own counsel.
Exactly. And Justice Souter also pointed out that, you know, judges, they're busy, they have tons of cases, they might not have the time to really dig deep and find every possible issue.
Right, that's a resource issue as well.
Exactly. And so they felt like Wendy was diluting that constitutional guarantee of effective counsel.
It's a fascinating debate, for sure.
Yeah.
So what's been the impact of Smith v. Robbins? I mean, this case was decided a while ago now. Has it actually changed the way states do things?
It has. It's had a pretty big impact. Since Smith v. Robbins, a bunch of other states have gone ahead and adopted these WENDA-like procedures. In fact, it's estimated that over 10 states now use some form of this approach.
So it's become fairly widespread.
Mm-hmm.
But I imagine there are still some people who are, you know, not thrilled about this trend, right?
Mm-hmm.
Especially those who advocate for indigent defendants.
Oh, absolutely. There's been a lot of criticism. Legal scholars, advocacy groups, even some judges have said, look, we think these WENDA-like procedures are actually bad for defendants who can't afford a lawyer. They worry that because lawyers don't have to point out specific issues, some good arguments might get missed. And even though the court is supposed to do its own review, they might not catch everything either.
It comes back to that question of what does effective assistance of counsel really mean, right? Especially in these tough cases where the lawyer thinks the appeal is going nowhere.
Exactly. And, you know, it's interesting. The Supreme Court didn't just rubber stamp the WENDA procedure.
Right. They didn't just say, okay, California, you're good. They actually sent Mr. Robbins' case back down to the Ninth Circuit.
Right. They remanded the case.
Yeah.
And they told the Ninth Circuit, hey, you need to take another look at this specific case using the Strickland v. Washington standard. And as you know, Strickland is all about ineffective assistance of counsel.
Right, that two-prong test.
Yeah.
So what was the Supreme Court getting at with that remand? Why send it back for more review?
They were making a really important point. They were saying, just because WENDA is okay as a general procedure doesn't mean that Mr. Robbins actually got effective assistance of counsel in his case. So the Ninth Circuit, they had to go back and decide, did his lawyer mess up by filing a WENDA brief instead of an Anders brief? Did that actually harm Mr. Robbins' case?
So it's possible for a procedure to be okay in theory, but then the way a lawyer uses it in a specific case could still be problematic.
Exactly, exactly. The Supreme Court was drawing a distinction between, you know, the big picture constitutionality of the procedure itself and then whether a specific lawyer actually did their job correctly in a particular case. And I think that's a crucial nuance.
It definitely is. So any final thoughts on Smith v. Robbins? Big takeaways for our listeners.
I think the biggest takeaway is this. While states do have some leeway to create their own procedures for these appeals where the lawyer thinks it's a lost cause, they can't just ignore the defendant's right to counsel. They have to make sure those procedures are really protecting that right.
It's all about striking that balance, right? We want efficiency in the courts, but we also want to make sure that everyone, rich or poor, has a real chance to have their appeal heard.
Absolutely. And I think Smith v. Robbins really leaves us with some important questions to think about. When we let states move away from the specific steps laid out in Anders, are we potentially shortchanging indigent defendants? Are we making it harder for them to get a fair shake on appeal? These are really important questions that I think everyone involved in the criminal justice system needs to be thinking about. And I hope this deep dive has given our listeners some food for thought.
Absolutely. And some questions to grapple with, right?
Yeah.
Especially as you continue your legal studies and think about what kind of impact you want to have on this system.
That's the goal.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us for this deep dive into Smith v. Robbins. It's been a really, you know, complex but important case to unpack.
It has.
And we hope you'll join us next time as we delve into another fascinating legal issue.
Always a pleasure.
Until then. Keep on learning.